Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
I loved having Bonner, and our goal was to be theoretical in the first half of it, and I think we mostly stayed there. We brought some practical tire meets the road stuff together, and we're gonna go now to some specific instances within the church and how we can protect ourselves, engage the church in a way in which it's not running us. We're taking charge of our own engagement levels and different things like that. Bill, you were telling me a story when we were off the air that just kind of seems to me like a nice bridge between the theoretical and the practical. Do you want to share that story, and then we'll just use? I know it's not specifically about church, individual interviews or anything like that that we'll get into, but it's still pretty neat. Would you share it?
Sure. Let's start with the family. I had an occasion 2 days ago to help my son move some furniture for a relative, and he wasn't appreciating the way I was helping. I wasn't following his instructions well enough, and so he got really upset and irritated. And in the course of that discussion, he said, "If you're not going to follow my instructions, since I'm the leader and this is my project, maybe I don't want to have you help me."
Wow.
My response was, if I have to surrender my ideas and being creative and offering something else in order to help you, maybe I don't want to help you.
Awesome.
So with that tension, which I think is exactly what Bonner was talking about, we ended up with a discussion over the next hour over our values and our model of helping and service and what it means and what parts of yourself you try to hang on to and not hang on to. And we actually experienced a transcendence that the second half of that project went better than we've ever worked together before.
Very cool. Very cool. Extrapolate a little bit bigger to, maybe how that might work with, would it be just any kind of leader or this sort of move of Bonner's of, you don't know how hard it's making me to engage here with this sort of attitudes or these kinds of things being said.
Right. I really wish I'd had some of Bonner's insights about how to not confront that quite so dramatically. But the authority, the different roles of authority, I mean, he was the authority of the project. I was the authority because I'm his dad. He had a certain way he wanted to do it. I had some ideas that I wanted to have respected.
Yeah.
That type of interaction plays out over and over again in the church and probably in every organization where there are leaders and followers.
Yeah. And instead of running from it, you guys pushed through it and it came out the best. Best ever. So
yeah.
That's wonderful.
That was lucky.
Very cool. Oh, neat. Katie, how about, I know that you wrote a powerful blog post. I looked today, and I had like 382 comments on it.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly where it is now, 12 hours later or whatever, when we're recording this. But you wrote at Doves and Serpents about your own experience of feeling like the institution had created a situation in which an individual, you felt violated, abused, intruded upon in a way that really shook you up for quite a few of your teenage years and into young adulthood and things like that. So why don't we just start our practical section with the worthiness interview as one of those institutional things that takes negotiation, that takes boundaries and things like that. So do you mind telling your story and you know, share whatever the blog post, whatever pieces of that you'd like to? And then, Bill, I'd love you, especially as a bishop, former bishop, to listen in on this and kind of share.
That'd be great.
Sure. Yeah. Well, my story is, you know, is such that when I was a young teenager, 13 years old or so, I had an interview with my bishop. It was just one of the annual, you know, the annual check-ins. It wasn't a temple recommend interview or anything like that. It was just one of those that they schedule, you know, on a semi-regular basis, where the bishop asked a series of increasingly personal questions and got to the point that, as I look back on it now as an adult, recognize that they were quite inappropriate questions. They were explicit sexual questions. And the experience was profoundly traumatic for me at such a tender age. I mean, you know, when you're 13 years old, at least when I was 13 years old, I guess I shouldn't universalize, but you're just in the process of beginning to develop a sense of autonomy. You're just in the process of beginning to develop a sense of your own sexuality and feeling as though, you know, those details were not just my business, but were perhaps the business of, you know, this neighbor, you know, fellow of mine who was a very, I think, well-meaning person, but, you know, it had a profound impact on me. I had already, from a younger age, I had already begun to struggle a bit with anxiety, but this particular experience triggered almost a 15-year struggle with obsessive anxiety around the topic of, you know, of interviews. I constantly worried that I would do something or had done something that might warrant a confession, you know, in a bishop's office. And it was a horrible thought for me because of how uncomfortable and unpleasant that, you know, that experience had been in my bishop's office as a kid, that I almost couldn't imagine anything worse, you know, and so I was constantly worried about it. And as I, you know, as I grew and, you know, got help for my anxiety problems and began to, you know, heal to a large extent from those things and found my place spiritually and felt empowered in my relationship with God and so on and so forth, I began to kind of change the way that I looked at that, not as kind of, you know, a necessary thing or something that was, you know, that was somehow helpful or useful to keep people on the straight and narrow or to keep me on the straight and narrow even, but, you know, began to look at that more and more as something deeply disturbing. And a practice that, you know, that probably doesn't serve us well. It doesn't serve, you know, the youth very well, I think, to be put in that kind of situation. And it's frankly dangerous.
Plus, you bring up that the ideal of confession is that it's voluntary,
right?
And things like that. And this is like anything but voluntary, especially with this age differential and
the
all these
differential.
The power. Yeah, everything that's going
the
on
gender
there.
Differential in my case, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, and so then you call for, let's reexamine the worthiness interview structure. You talk, you propose things. Some of this came up, but we did a proactive LDS parenting podcast, and certainly I'd been hearing this for years, but you kind of coalesced it all into a really neat piece. But what were some of the recommendations that you had? I know too deep interviewing, never have a youth alone with a bishop. What else did you call for?
I made a couple of practical recommendations. Then I also have like a deeper kind of theological point that I want to make as well, or that I did make in the post. But first of all, I call for extensive training on how to deal with reported incidents of sexual abuse or activity in minors, including protocols on when to notify authorities, parents or guardians, and or refer out to therapists or other trained professionals. I think a lot of times our bishops are, you know, extremely well-meaning. They are, I think, by and large, the vast majority of them are good men trying to do their very, very best. But they're not trained, you know, they're not trained to deal with matters of sexuality. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you know, that I'm going to be pursuing a master's degree in marriage and family counseling, and that requires 2 years of graduate school and then 800 hours of clinical supervised therapy before I'm in a position that I'm able to kind of go out and counsel people about personal matters, like legally, and, you know, open my own practice or something like that. So I think sometimes there's a sense that if we're dealing with spiritual or personal or emotional or sexual matters, that that the spirit will guide us, and the spirit certainly can guide us, but just as the spirit isn't going to guide me to be a rocket scientist kind of out of the blue one day, I don't know that the spirit can kind of automatically guide our bishops to know how to handle some of these more sensitive issues. So probably the best thing we can do is have protocols on when they can recognize that there may be in something a little more deep than they have the training to deal with, and to refer out to people who can help. A second suggestion I have is two deep interviews, so that minors and priesthood leaders are never in a room alone together. I think we have to be careful with this, as a couple of people, insightful people, pointed out in the comments. Like, if you had, say, the bishop and the first counselor in the bishopric in the room, if the power differential is challenging with just the minor and the bishop, then with, you know, both the bishop and the first counselor, for example, in there, it could be staggering. So I think we should do two deep interviews, but maybe someone that maybe the youth could pick their own advocate, you know, to go in with them, whether it's a parent or a trusted leader or something like that, would be something that would be useful. And then kind of the theological change that I would propose is I recommend that we look again at teachings and policies that require special confession for sexual sins. I don't think, from a theological standpoint, that sexual sin should be categorized as this special brand of sin that requires confession. And I think there's a lot of scriptural evidence to support that position. And I think there's absolutely no scriptural evidence to support the idea that sexual sin is like its unique brand of sin that's especially bad.
Yeah, I love your using the C.S. Lewis diabolical vices, which I guess he defines as sins that arise from hatred or hardness of hearts. You say those are far worse than ones that rise from passion or weakness of flesh.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. That was a pretty good stuff there.
So I think we could avoid a lot of this. I think we could avoid the whole conundrum entirely if we recognized, you know, if we recognized that sexual sin, you know, certainly lust and, you know, fornication, these sorts of things are, adultery are talked about, you know, in scripture and Jesus has some things to say about them. But, you know, I think that branding them like as somehow it's their own evil category that like goes beyond all and the sin next to murder and so on and so forth does us a disservice. And I think it's because of those teachings that bishops feel like they have to pride, that they have to kind of elicit a full confession or that they have to ask questions that are, you know, bordering on inappropriate. So maybe relooking at some of those things that we're telling ourselves about sex could be very useful in shifting the paradigm so that these interviews, at least in the form that they sometimes take, you know, maybe don't have to be conducted quite in the way that we've begun to conduct them.
right. And so, Bill, I want to have you completely jump in here in a minute, but there's one more layer here now, Katie, and that is these are institutional changes we'd like to see happen. Until then, you sort of have a section of, and this is that, you know, here's your asserting yourself, you're protecting yourself right now. And what were some of your suggestions there of things that you might do with or conversations you'd have with your children?
Yeah. So the things that I intend to do and try to model in my house, which, you know, I'm sure I do some things better than others, but the first is to insist on being present in interviews. Like, until there are some institutional checks and balances in place to make me feel comfortable that the interviews are, you know, more likely to be beneficial than not, you know, that risk for me right now seems too high. And I grant that that's, you know, a lot of that probably has to do with my own experience and how, you know, how they were for me. But until I feel like they're safer, you know, my daughters right now are 6 and 3 months old. And no, so I'm not facing it quite yet, but I'll be there. I will be insistent that I'm present in those interviews. And if, you know, if that's not acceptable, then the interview just won't happen. That's just the way it'll be. My second point is to teach children principles of sexual agency, and that is to help them understand from a young age that their bodies belong to them and not to somebody else, and that people don't have the right to ask them intimate questions, as I wrote in the post, about their bodies, genitals, masturbatory practices, or personal relationships, and that it's okay to say no, I won't answer that, it's none of your business. And then the third point I made was to foster a healthy questioning of authority, and that is the point that, you know, as children mature, their objective is to internalize their own spiritual authority and stand before God as fully actualized spiritual agents. That ultimately, you know, kind of falling fowler, you know, that as we grow, you know, we shift the authority from an external source, our parents, our leaders, the church, whatever, and we move it inward to where we are responsible then to take, you know, to take charge of our own spiritual lives. And so I want to model that for my children and show them that that's kind of the path, and that it's okay for them to hear something, and if it doesn't resonate with them and if it doesn't feel right to them, for them to explore why it doesn't resonate and why it doesn't feel right, and that it's okay for them to come to their own conclusion, and that I will support them in coming to a conclusion, even if it's different from mine, you know, or if it's different from something that they're hearing at church or whatever, and hopefully just empower them to stand on their own 2 feet and to grow, you know, and blossom the way, you know, the way that they want to.
Awesome. Yeah, this is a great post, and congratulations on, you know, fostering such a great discussion about it. Bill, I want to hear from you on like half a dozen different levels of this. You know, I want to know what bishops are told in terms of the worthiness interviews. What are the guidelines? Are things that she's talking about aberrations? Is it in the instructions? And then I want to hear about, you know, did you have people draw these boundaries? How do you respond to it? What would be a good way to do it if you felt called as a parent to do that and things? So just riff.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate Katie on bringing up the issue. It's well thought out and called to mind, just in more of a playful response, some of our family stories. The first one that came to mind is I have a daughter who's just went to a baby shower she's expecting in a couple of months, and one of the overbearing relatives kept pressing her for an extended period of time about whether she was going to breastfeed. And she tried very politely to say, that's a private decision. I'm not going to talk about that here. And the more she resisted, the more pressure was put on here. And Lisa, who happened to be at the baby shower.
This is Lisa, your wife.
Yes, she ended up intervening. She said, oh, by the way, she said, I've nursed all of my 7 children until they were 12 years of age. She said, I even used nursing children to get out of church callings. I just had to tell the bishop, I'm sorry, I'm busy. The kids are lined up and they have to have dinner. So she tried to deflect that.
By just showing kind of outrageously.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And another one was, I have a nephew who was dealing with a very overbearing bishop, you know, that was involved with these worthiness interviews. And he reported to me, he said, Uncle Bill, my bishop asked me, he said, young man, do you have problem with masturbation? And he said, heck no, bishop, it works every time.
Yeah, that's a famous line. So if he either borrowed that or something, but yeah, it is a great line. Yeah,
I'm sure.
but yeah. So yeah, what is the deal with bishops that even are you supposed to ask these questions?
Well, generally speaking, you're supposed to encourage the youth to examine spiritually whether they feel worthy.
Worthy to do what? To have the Holy Ghost?
For example, the case where it came up most poignantly to me is there was a young man that came to me, and I asked a general, thoughtful, not too prying questions about sexual worthiness and things. He left immediately thereafter, went on his mission, where in the MTC, they don't mince words.
Right.
And he began to have a guilty conscience and confessed to the bishop or MTC branch president, whatever, there, that he had engaged in masturbation. Because he had not confessed that specifically to his bishop, he was let go from his mission. His call was revoked, and he was sent home. I've seen that happen over and over again. I don't agree with that, but the idea is that if you've lied to your bishop or an authority, then they're not going to tolerate that out there.
But you didn't explicitly ask him, so you're feeling like, wow.
Yeah, did I miss the boat in not asking him specifically? What I would have done with Katie's suggestions as a bishop is, first of all, I would acknowledge to the person I was talking to that I'm in both a privileged position and a power position. As a bishop, I'm powerful, and as a man in our society, I acknowledge that there's some forms of privilege and some fears and other things that come along with that as people deal with a person in that position. Second thing I would do is invite parents in to worthiness type interviews and ask all of them if they felt between themselves that they had a trusting relationship, a knowledgeable relationship, and a disclosing relationship with each other without prying into details. And then hope that would spark, you know, if they wanted to talk to me privately at some future date, then they could voluntarily come in and we could have a discussion, you know, in another type of trusting setting that they might initiate.
Now, that would be Bill Hansen, brilliant guy, self-aware guy. What are the dang instructions that you receive? What's the bishop's what's the handbook of instructions?
Right.
What does it say? What does it tell you you're there to do? You're a judge in Israel? Does it go specific? You need to deliver sexually pure children to God. I want to know what the heck it says.
Well, of course, there's no specific instruction about that, but you are given the responsibility to make sure that the youth understand what it means to be sexually pure. And I'm sure different bishops interpret that in different ways, and some are pretty dogmatic about it, and really a little bit of training could go a long way.
So, Katie, should it ever come up at all?
I don't think so. Here's what I think. Pastoral care in general is something that can be very positive for people. You know, it's wonderful to feel like you have an ecclesiastical leader, someone who can be a spiritual mentor for you, that you can go to when you are feeling distressed, that you can go to when you're confused, when you need guidance, when you need help, and that you can approach voluntarily. So I'm all on board with that, and I'm on board with people who feel like they penitents, you know, who feel like they need to get something off their chest, going to a trusted advisor in a spirit of confession and repentance. Like that's totally
so
great.
So if the person brings it up, okay to talk about it.
Sure.
Church should never talk about it. other than just like there's one area of people's spiritual lives, sometimes it deals with sexuality, etc. If you want to talk about that, I'm open to it. Otherwise, I wouldn't. Is that even too far from the ecclesiastical leader?
I think it's okay for the ecclesiastical leader to say something along the lines of, you know, how can I help you? What's going on in your life that I can help you with? Leave it very open-ended and let the people share what they want to share.
Bill, a rebuttal? Like, how often did it turn out to be a very positive and important thing that you had these discussions with youth?
It turns out to be really important, especially for the young men. I think there's a gender difference there, and sometimes, especially with the young men, it's not a matter of educating them to something or introducing them to something that they're not familiar with. Of course, there are exceptions to that, as it is to setting a stage where you can actually bring up a topic and not beat around the bush, that it doesn't make everybody blush to use the term masturbate, or that they think if they don't say it, that it must have been okay, or something like that. Maybe I'm not explaining that very well, but...
Well, some would say that masturbation is okay, as long as it doesn't become chronic.
Yeah, that's what I say.
Yeah.
That's my perspective. It's like, that, and that's the trouble. To me, that's the real theological conundrum that we're in, or the position that we've painted ourselves in is, you know, maybe overanalyzing the situation a little bit, but because we have, for some reason, like this deep-seated anxiety about sexuality, you know, kind of as a culture, you know, we've created this false concept that, you know, sexuality and sexual sin is somehow on this whole other level, worse or different or, you know, somehow like far more heinous than, you know, than another type of sin, so bad that, you know, if you masturbate, you know, you almost killed your grandma. You could have, because really the worst sin is murder, but no one's going to commit murder. So basically that's what you've done. You know what I mean? And I think it's really unhealthy that's the teaching that we have and that's the discourse that we have. I don't think there's any scriptural or spiritual evidence for that at all. So if I were, you know, making the rules, I would have us move entirely away from that, maybe recalibrate and have more healthy perspectives on sexuality, and then we could leave some of those questions alone.
I agree with what you're saying. My experience is that oftentimes with young people who are experiencing sexual things for the first time or being initiated, for some reason the idea comes up in their minds, I know a secret that maybe my leaders don't even know. I'm on to something that, you know, I've never heard any adults really discuss openly, and so... you know, I'm the holder of the special knowledge. And so one of the ideas that comes up in that type of a setting is just to let them know that, hey, as a leader, you can talk to me about this and it's not a surprise. And I think that type of setup sometimes leads to the impropriety that you're talking about. It's hard to know where to draw the line.
But you think it's worth the risk, Bill, sounds like.
Probably depends on the individual, but I have confronted individuals, both adults and children, in worthiness interviews who were kind of relieved to know that I wasn't going to jump up and run out the room if they mentioned some kind of sexual impropriety, that I'd heard about it before. But then again,
they'd be initiating that rather than you. Or
yeah, sure.
Okay. So again, I think we're kind of okay with that, Katie, at least to some degree. You said if they're penitent or if they have a question, they go to the bishop. You feel better about that.
I do feel better about that, especially if we have checks in place that make it very clear when the bishop really needs to refer out, you know what I mean, to a competent professional.
Well, and I've got a little bit different background because I handle criminal cases in that area, and my wife's in the PhD program of marriage and family therapy at BYU, so I get to be her guinea pig, and I hear a lot of this coming from the other way, so I like your insight.
Okay, I guess we can be done with this. Some of the things that worried me, Bill, you know, like when I say we have these worthiness interviews, so worthy for what? And I always worry that it's like worthy of God's love, you know? You know, it's, yeah, worthy to exercise your priesthood, worthy to, you know, do baptisms for the dead, all that kind of stuff is one thing. You know, the Holy Ghost was less likely to be your constant companion, or you won't have as clear a signal. These are all things. But when my worry about just the emphasis on worthiness is it turns so easily to I'm unlovable and hiding and shame, and it just makes it so much worse. So I'm almost like a no worthiness interview guy, but yet developing like a better relationship with the bishop and the youth. Do you think the youth chats or things could ever like do it, you know, at the broad level, and then the only time it ever comes up in a private setting is at their initiation after they've been exposed to you and, you know, have a comfort level with, if they want to talk, they could.
You know, maybe Katie knows about this more than I do, but I have experienced youth that are very reluctant, very reticent to bring up anything in a group type setting, and they'll just sit there and absorb it passively.
Oh, and no, yeah, I didn't mean to have the discussions at the youth chat. It would be like they, at least the topic's been broached. They now know that there's a they've got a sense of the bishop and his attitude towards this if it's something they ever would want to talk about, rather than sort of imposing it as part of a structure. That's what I'm saying in the one-on-ones.
You're saying.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying.
I don't know. It's a hard thing.
I like that, man. Going back to your point about, you know, about worthiness, like I think there's a lot of room, and we have a lot of theological resources to kind of get out of the worthiness mentality generally. I think that, you know, that the idea of worthiness in many cases is actually antithetical to the gospel of Christ, which teaches on a certain level, you know, as it says in the Book of Mormon, we're all unprofitable servants. We're all unworthy. We all sin and fall short of the glory of God. And yet that's the good news.
Awesome.
And so I think that, you know, a greater emphasis on grace, a greater emphasis on each of us as sinners, each of us struggling, each of us trying, you know, to rise to the challenge of Christian living is a much healthier narrative, as opposed to this. And yet we're blessed in spite of our unworthiness, and that this is what grace is, as opposed to this narrative that we have to be good enough to merit blessing, you know?
Right, right.
And just a few paradigm shifts along those lines, I think, would make a huge difference in the way that, you know, in I guess going back to our conversation with Bonner, would make a huge difference in reducing the harm or the evil of the institution.
Katie, let me ask you this. How would you deal with the tension between the idea that God loves me like I am, and on the other hand, trying to help, either in an institutional setting or a family setting, somebody know how to make progress and actually be personally responsible and repent? On the one hand, if you call people's attention to something, you know, you get a response that says, you don't love me, you know, or you don't love the real me. On the other hand, sometimes people sit back and, you know, they're complacent with their own personal addictions of one form or other and say, you know, God loves me the way I am. I don't really need to do anything about it.
I think that's a great question. I think that to a large extent, it really goes back to the topic of conversation that we're having today, which is boundaries. I think to a large extent, this is a boundary issue. And that is, whenever, I think we're on shaky ground anytime we look at another person and want them to change. Because I think that a person's desire to change really must rise from the person themselves. So I think it's up to us to show unconditional love towards the people that we have in our lives and to accept them as they are. Now, another part of boundaries is that sometimes people are going to choose things that make it like less possible for us to be super like involved with them. You know what I mean? Like if they're doing profoundly destructive, hurtful, unkind, evil things to us, then, you know, respecting their boundaries, respecting the boundaries and respecting their autonomy and their free agency to do that says, look, you know, I love you, but I'm going to love you from over here because I accept that this is the way you're being. And I accept that I can't change you. And I'm not going to try because we can't change other people, that they can only change themselves. But you know, God bless you and go with goodwill. Now, so that's one thing, that those are people, if they're really not interested in changing. Now, if there are people who are interested in changing in our lives and we can be a positive resource for them, you know, that's something else entirely. But we can't be invested in them changing. Instead, we have to kind of support them, come alongside them, mourn with them, you know, encourage them, love them through.
Model something healthy.
Model it right. And communicate to them that we really care about them and their progress, especially if they too are invested in their progress. But boy, I, you know, how much pain, how much energy, you know, do we spend, you know, trying to get other people to do things that they're just not ready, willing, or able, you know, to do, when instead we can give them space and grace and say, look, that's your fight. That's your struggle. I'm here for you to support you, but I'm not going to try to impose this change on you. And to a large extent, like the whole structure of the worthiness interviews and some of the other things, like the constant checking in that happens in the church, feels to me like a major boundary violation in that regard, that it's like, you know, we're not just giving people the space to kind of let them be and standing by as resources and as helps and as friends, but instead we're like trying to actually force people into conformity. And I think that's unhealthy.
I like what you've said. I agree with those principles and values. I've come to appreciate those through the counseling program. And as a trained counselor, sounds like you'll be a good one.
Nice.
You really can't control people or force people to change. And so your role as a counselor really is different than you might at first expect. I really like the principles and the values that you were talking about. I think in the church, we just need a lot more social training,
right,
and to refer to professionals with sticky situations. That sounds like a great idea. To develop good boundaries as parents, as church members, as leaders, I think is critical. Good boundaries make everyone happy. As Robert Frost says, good fences make good neighbors.
Right.
And I think that's really appropriate.
Hey, listeners. Dan here, just jumping in with an addendum that wasn't part of the conversation. I was gone this weekend camping. I went with my daughter and a during the course of the conversation with my daughter, it came up some things she was hearing in her mission prep class at UVU. She's not sure 100% if she wants to go on a mission or not, but she thought she'd take a mission prep for her institute class this semester. And we got talking about worthiness and what are the rules for people going and this or not. And she really liked a point that her institute teacher brought up. I liked it too, but not as much as she did, but it did lend me to some thinking that might be interesting to insert here. Basically, he was like, let's not get into the legalist. If you have sex, you can't go for a year. If you do these, if you don't do those things. He goes, he thinks the whole point of saying whether or not and assessing whether or not you're worthy of a mission is to play on the word worthiness and play on the root worth. And that is, what of worth can I contribute to God? And to look at yourself and to say, what are my gifts? What are my strengths? Can I put these in the service of God? And so she liked this very positive assessing your worth to God, whether it's in the mission field or whatever, as kind of a neat, you know, twist on the idea of worthiness, like, are you worthy to go or whatever. Anyway, it just dawned on me that wouldn't it be interesting if, you know, even if the church weren't to change the practice of calling in the youth every 6 months or every year on their birthday and just having that bishop be a mentor in their life and be an available adult who's wise and things like that. And you know, even if there might be externally the call to call these things worthiness interviews, or at least a part of it a worthiness interview, wouldn't it be so cool if the instruction could be, bishops, when you call these kids in, when these kids come in here, no matter what you hear, no matter what you say, this is a you are of worth interview. This is a you are of worth touchstone for them in their lives. So that if in the comfort level that you've established with them, these things come up, you certainly can guide. You certainly can say, yep, that's not as ideal as it could have been or something like this. But over and over, the message would be, you are of worth. And I don't know, this is from that little bit working on my brain these last couple days before I edited this second half of our discussion here. I thought I would throw that in there and would love your thoughts in the comments or whatever about it. But it seems to me like that's a shift that we could make. And what a big change it would make, even if the structures don't change right away. So anyway, back to the discussion. Before we leave this one, Bill, let me just ask one thing. Did you ever have parents say, I'm not comfortable with you ever talking to my child about these things? And if you did, how did that feel good to you? How did they communicate it to you successfully? Or how do you think you would have handled it if you really didn't have a firsthand experience?
The closest thing I ever had to something like that was a situation where I had to interview a young engaged couple. And I made some recommendations. They were very anxious to get married, let's talk about it that way. And I didn't notice the discomfort that they had, but all of a sudden I found out a couple of months later that they had actually quietly moved out of the ward and gotten married in St. George. So it kind of surprised me that there was something like that. But that was the closest that I came to what you're talking about.
But would you have felt comfortable? Like, so Katie would have been helpful if Katie says, you know, I had terrible experiences as a youth with this part of it. I just don't want my daughter to, or my son to sit here and be asked about these things. I think I have that kind of open, disclosing relationship with her. And would you agree to not ever ask those things? Or I would like to be present in the interview. How would you, does that seem reasonable? Do you think most bishops these days would handle that pretty well?
Oh, I think so. I certainly would be open to it, and I'd like to think that I'm not the only one. You know, maybe there's a control freak or two out there, but I think we're all, as a society, becoming more and more sensitized to people's concerns in that area, and we want to be responsive. Both of those suggestions sound good to me.
Cool. All right, well, that's a good area. Katie, anything more before we move on? And I think we're only have time to deal one more, and that's, Bill, you brought it up with Bonner early on, and it's about the calling situation. Do you want to repeat your take on, you know, just sort of what you experienced as a person who did extend callings? Would you start with that, and then I've got a few follow-ups.
Sure. It made me uncomfortable as a bishop to come to somebody or invite somebody in and then say, you know, in the name of the Lord, we feel inspired to extend this calling, and if you don't accept it, then, you know, the problem's with you.
Right, and I haven't ever had that in at least the last 10 or 15 years. No one's ever pulled the God wants you, you know, thing. Do you think it's pretty common still?
I've heard it now and again. I know I've heard that there are some that still use that approach. We feel inspired, you know, will you accept the calling? And then whether or not they accept, it's kind of the litmus test of righteousness.
Okay, but you extending a calling, and you think most bishops, they recognize how the process works in their own mind, and they probably won't lay that guilt trip on you.
Yeah, but I think there aren't a lot that go the extra step. I mean, to me, you don't have revelation until the person himself says, how is this going to impact my life, and gives you the personal information that you need to be able to complete a decision. I mean, you awesome. may feel like somebody's the best Relief Society president of all, but if, you know, she's battling cancer, right, in the quiet, you know, you're probably going to change your opinion.
But yet, wouldn't God tell you that? I mean, again, this is like managing expectations versus the reality of the process of extending in a call, right? God should reveal to you that she's got cancer. I'm just trying to get you to you know, because that's a lot of people won't understand what you're saying about the revelation isn't complete until you hear from the person.
I just feel like the more information that you can get to help you understand the situation better, you know, is something that you should get. If you're going to rely on your own uninformed judgment, that's a pretty arrogant position to take, I think.
Are there instructions that kind of point people in the direction that you were trying?
Not that I've seen. I think it's just a tradition, more or less, you know, about how callings are extended and received.
Yeah. Katie, do you have any recommendations for, I mean, have you made it past that hurdle of, I'm a big part of this revelatory process of whether or not this calling is what I should take? Or if so, how did you get there? And if not, what's holding you back?
Yeah. Yes, I'm comfortable turning down callings. And
was it a big hurdle to get to that point?
Yes, it totally was. It was really stressful. You know, it was about a year and a half ago that I ever turned down a calling. And it was kind of a stressful experience. I didn't do it with as much grace or as much firmness as perhaps I would, you know, today, you know, but I was able to say, you know, to the bishop, gosh, I don't actually feel super comfortable, you know, doing that job. And here are a couple of reasons why. And he asked me to try it out. It was a calling in the nursery. And he asked me to try it out. And, you know, so I went for a week, and then I was like, no, it still doesn't quite seem like a fit to me. And he was pretty good about it and was like, that's okay. I think, like, now, hopefully I would be able to say no, like if it were a calling that I just didn't feel like that I wanted to do, I hope I wouldn't make an excuse for it or an apology for why I didn't feel like I could do it. You know, instead, I think I hope that I would be able to say, gosh, thank you for the opportunity. You know, I don't really feel like this is maybe something that I'd like to do right now, and leave it at that without trying to justify, you know, that decision. But it was hard, like, to get to the point where I would even be willing to speak up and be like, I don't know that I, you know, I'm super comfortable with this, or this isn't something that, you know, I would feel super great about. It was scary, you know, and it took a few times of doing callings and resenting them.
Interesting.
You know, well, no, you know, I'll pass on this opportunity for now. So,
Bill, and as a bishop, would you want the multiple, here's my reasons why, or what do you think about, is that just a personality thing?
Well, I think you have to be open to whatever the person wants to say, but as Katie knows, with marriage and family therapy, that frequently in order to strengthen their expression, a person will rely on criticism or contempt or self-defensiveness or stonewalling. And once those elements are introduced in a response, it makes it pretty tough to just sit there. You have to develop some social graces of your own in order to, you know, deal with those type of negative responses.
Yeah, interesting. I'll just let you guys know, about 2 months ago, I turned down a calling, and it was interesting what happened. They asked me to be the cub master, And I had been the Cub Master before. I loved it. It was when my son was like his last 2 years of Cubs. It was the greatest experience. We had such a good time. And, you know, the whole pack was going great and all that stuff. So I really enjoyed it. And so it wouldn't have been the world's worst calling for that. But I was able to share with them. I said, you know, I'd really consider that and be inclined to accept it because I enjoy the boys and I know I shouldn't let politics and things get in it. But in this case, I said, the fact that to be a Cub Master, I would have to register with the Boy Scouts of America and be part of that organization in an official way, that's just not something that I'm willing to do. And I was able to explain a little bit about, you know, the gay and lesbian stuff as a, that's just not an organization I can support. And it led to a good 5-minute discussion with the person. I think it was nice that there was a counselor that was asking me, but I think, you know, we got to know each other better and he was fine at the end. He's just kind of like, you know, there's always a thing when you don't want to do a calling, you just say no. That's what I've done in my life in the past. So he was really mellow about it, but those kinds of things were there for me just recently. So I don't actually have official calling in my ward now. So I hope I didn't like poison the well for future, but that was just a pretty much, there's just no way I could officially join the Boy Scouts and, you know, to really magnify that calling, have to go to powwows and all the different things. So
maybe okay. We're evolving.
Who knows? Right?
Yeah.
Who knows? But, well, good. So that's another boundary area. Was there any other ones that you wanted to bring up? Everything's a tire meets the road thing. I think everything does fit into sort of what you were talking about, Katie, there with Fowler and stages and moving, you know, the center of authority to somebody else, to starting to feel more comfortable with your own skin, with your own connection with God, your own self-awareness of this is my life. Here are things that would work into my life and wouldn't work into my life. You know, here are boundaries that I've set for my children when it comes to, you know, non-family members and certain discussion topics. In some ways, it is almost just like a spiritual growth issue, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's feeling comfortable enough in yourself and feeling actualized enough as a spiritual agent to feel like you have the right to make those decisions and to set those boundaries for yourself. And I think sometimes in our culture, perhaps there might be some discouragement people to, you know, to get there because it tends to be when you move from like a 3 to a 4, if we're talking, you know, Fowler. And so as part of that process comes some deconstruction, comes some pain and some stress and some difficulty as well. It's not a cakewalk. But as you take those steps and as you make the journey, you begin to feel more empowered in yourself to kind of say no, like, yeah, like this is what I want to do, and that's not what I want to do, and that's okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's where I feel. And I don't know if anybody has anything more on, you know, callings and that stuff. But I think in general, we've done some good things with this podcast. We've introduced some concepts, some neat phrases, some you know, this far-ranging, big-brained, really insightful professor and his articles about this has given us some tools to sort of defang some of this boundary things. And now we've talked a little bit more about personal responsibilities, and Katie, you just helped us again right at the end to kind of firm it in terms of spiritual growth. So I'm pretty satisfied with where we've landed. If I were to throw to each of you for a final thought, let me just try that and we'll see what comes out. Bill, what's left to say tonight, or is there anything you want to reemphasize?
Just that in the church, I find church leaders that I encounter becoming more and more service-oriented and more aware of boundaries and
nice.
Open to people suggesting information where their boundaries may be at a little bit different place. I hope that continues.
And that's probably just the culture where their children are speaking up to them. Is it just almost like as society goes, maybe the church is going there too? Or do you think there's even instructions from the brethren towards that?
I think on a local level, there's some instruction that's going that way. I haven't seen on a, you know, on a general or universal level in the manuals those things being addressed.
I'm hoping the emphasis on councils and bringing women in, hopefully, you know, at a much higher level, I can't think that that can't help but help, right? Katie, are you optimistic in the way Bill is, or what would, you know, before I give you a chance for your thought, do you mind jumping in here?
I'm totally optimistic, but I'm, you know, I'm an optimist at heart. yeah, I'm totally optimistic. I mean, I think, you know, what you said about, you know, having women more involved and, you know, eventually let's have some, maybe even some institutional changes along those lines.
Right.
But as society becomes more aware, the church can't help but become more aware. Definitely.
Cool. Thanks, Katie. What would be your final thought, or, you know, I'll come back around to you if you have two final thoughts, but what anything else you want to emphasize or double down on?
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten a lot out of this conversation. You know, I think a few of the things that we talked about with Bonner really hit home to me as we were chatting. You know, one of those is the idea that change happens from the bottom up.
Right.
So right now, for me, it feels like I'm kind of in this place where I'm sort of swimming out here, maybe a little bit alone, you know, setting boundaries that other people aren't setting and thinking, man, like, when is it going to get easier? When is, you know, when might there be some institutional checks? When might there be some teaching, you know, coming down from the top that like affirms, you know, some of the things that I'm doing, you know, in terms of like saying no, or, you know, setting boundaries for my children and conversations or whatever, you know, whatever it is. But I'm really encouraged when I think of the fact that by me and us and those of us who are so inclined to take a few steps in this direction, we may well be able to affect some of this change as other people see that it becomes socially acceptable, you know, to do those kinds of things and to be open and engaged and, you know, full of love as you engage with the community, but still, you know, have a strong sense of self, have a strong sense of your own, you know, your own autonomy as a spiritual agent and being able to say with love, no thanks. You know what I mean?
As we do this
together, you know, and set boundaries and really stand on our own two feet, I guess, from a spiritual perspective, I can't help but think that sort of thing is going to make an important change. And even if it doesn't, you know, I mean, I guess maybe going back to what I was saying to Bill about how we have to respect and honor the choices of others, you know, then at that point, you know, we can decide the level to which, you know, to the level to which we'll engage. And we can make that decision based on things that are healthy for us. So again, like, I wouldn't say my engagement is contingent upon.
Right.
You know,
because you're standing on your own two feet. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I don't need the institution to fully change tomorrow, else I'm out.
Right. It's more a question of, you know, I can temper my level of engagement based on what I'm comfortable with, based on where my boundaries are, you know,
awesome.
and if that means, I think Jana Reese, I think she was either on your podcast or John's, you know, was talking one time about taking a year sabbatical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she
you know,
did.
I mean, these sorts of things are open to you. These sorts of options are open to you when you are standing on your own two feet. Like, you can do the unconventional thing and realize that, like, nobody can really stop you. Like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, when you don't give your power away, you realize you have a lot of power. So
awesome. So good. You know, your bit there about doing it together and, you know, if enough of us and stuff like that, it reminded me of one of my favorite quotes, and it's by Joan Chittister, who's a nun who represents a lot of cloistered Catholics and things. And her quote somewhere along the lines of, I don't know how many snowflakes it takes to break a branch, you know, like a tree branch, But she says, I want to have my snowflake be counted among the other ones that eventually, you know, create these changes. You know, and she kind of says, you know, what she sees going on around her is kind of the seeding of the question, the S-E-E-D-I-N-G. And so these things take their time, but she wants to be there when the, you know, the critical mass happens or something. We really do see the big shifts. So I like that. And anyway, somehow your thought there at least connected with that for me. Well, guys, I really loved having you on the show. We've had I hope it won't show up too much, but folks, we've had more technical problems with this podcast than any ever one before. So if it feels a little choppy, that was why. But the spiritual insights were great. The conversation was fun. You're such good friends, and I really love your good hearts and just amazing insights that you've shared. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Dan.
It's been a pleasure.
Hey, listeners, thank you so much for all you do to support Mormon Matters. It's so wonderful when you write and when you share ideas and things like that. But it's also, I have to say, very helpful when that support comes in the form of donations and subscriptions. So if you're so inclined, please keep donating. It would be it certainly makes things go much better in my life with this particular income stream. I do this in a somewhat of a sense of a calling to it and feeling like this is a natural fit for me, but right now it is a piece of how I put things together. So thank you again. Thank you, Katie and Bill. Bonner, loved having you. Good night, everyone.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye, guys.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
As well.